some early memories, like classical portraits, in all their never fading colors, are everlasting. In this memory, I'm about 4.5 years old, and I'm holding on to my mother's flowing gray cotton skirt and trying to match her footsteps. We walk into a big space I'd never been before, and we find a booth where my mother pulls a curtain closed behind us, and she's busy for just a few moments on a shelf high above my head. Then we're walking out again. This cameo has never vanished from my mind. The year must have been 1930, and my mom was voting for probably the 10th time in her life as a woman and a citizen of the United States. I kind of know my mother wanted me to remember that day to make voting a part of who I am. So it's me too here celebrating the 100 years since the passage of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution that proclaimed the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Now, in the year 2020, we realize that a constitutional amendment has never settled an issue for always. It's only a way station on the road to suffrage for all Americans. As the United States began as a nation, most voters were white men who owned property and paid taxes. When slavery was abolished after the Civil War, there were racist factions back then who pushed for the deportation of African Americans. That familiar tune, "Go Back Where You Came From." It took some fighting for freed slaves and poor whites to become voters. It took 5 years after the Civil War's end for the 15th Amendment to the Constitution to pass. It proclaimed the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. The Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Curiously, for women who were citizens, it took half a century until 1920 to receive that sacred right of citizens. In those 50 years, women, suffragettes, marched and demonstrated and found themselves arrested and abused by police and those in power. And yet, there were among them racist white women who couldn't stand up for voting rights for all women. Yes. I find myself speaking of the sacred right to vote and the sacred right of freedom for all. Harriet Tubman's mission to lead the enslaved to freedom and to join the Union's fight against the Confederacy arose when she received the voice of the holy, that sacred voice, with its call to free all God's children. And so it was also with Sojourner Truth, another black woman who was about 25 years older than Harriet Tubman. Sojourner Truth was born into slavery in New York State, not the South. She too escaped slavery when she was about 30. In her mid-40s, she too received the call of the holy as the fight was heating up to abolish slavery. On Pentecost Sunday in 1843, she left her job as a housekeeper, changed her name from Isabella Bomefree to Sojourner Truth, and she told her friends, "The Spirit calls me to preach the truth, and I must go." Sojourner Truth soon met William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass, and a year later, she delivered her first anti-slavery speech. In 1851, she attended the Ohio Women's Rights Convention in Akron, Ohio. There, she delivered her famous extemporaneous speech on women's rights, later known as "Ain't I a Woman," where she demanded equal rights for all women as well as for all blacks. Sojourner Truth had a way of taking to the stage with her demanding and composed presence, so composed that some in the audience found it hard to believe she was even a woman. In later years, her speech became known as "Ain't I a Woman." Although no recordings exist of Sojourner Truth speech, it's been passed along into history that she argued that man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody helps me to any best place, and ain't I a woman? At least once in 1858, someone interrupted her speech and accused her of being a man. So she opened her blouse and revealed her breasts. With the end of slavery, at the end of the Civil War, as the struggle for equal rights took the foreground, among her hundreds of speeches, Sojourner Truth told our country that black men were winning new rights. Now was the best time to give black women the rights they deserved too. She ended her argument by accusing men of being self-centered. She said, "Man is so selfish that he has got women's rights and his own too, and yet he won't give women their rights. He keeps them all to himself." Sojourner Truth died in November 1883. That was 37 years before women finally won the right to vote. Sojourner Truth, like Harriet Tubman, was later raised to sainthood by the Episcopal Church and the Lutheran Church. So, no problem, right? As of 150 years ago, all men had the right to vote. 100 years ago, all women won the right to vote. Better late than never. Alas, that's never been the truth of our nation. This era, the 21st century, asks us again to face the painful truth. The right to vote has been attacked and retracted and denied in every way possible since those amendments passed. Waves of change bring us times of restored civil rights and the vision that we've overcome the worst. Then new upheaval threatens our democracy. The Voting Rights Amendments give to Congress the power to enforce them by legislation. The states, however, have the power to set up procedures that control who votes and who's turned away. By the early 20th century, every state in the Deep South adopted a new state constitution explicitly to disenfranchise blacks and poor whites. They started with poll taxes, literacy tests, arbitrary registration practices, and threats to life and to safety. It took more than half a century of civil unrest and marches for democracy until the passing of the Voting Rights Act by Congress in 1965. The Voting Rights Act ended the worst of these state laws. But just 7 years ago, in the words of our civil rights icon, John Lewis, the Supreme Court, he said, put a dagger in the heart of the Voting Rights Act in its decision in Shelby County versus Holder. The court asserted that racism had come to an end in election practices, and so too federal oversight must end. Instantly, states opened the floodgates of voter suppression. They raced to install hurdles to voter registration, to reduce access to the ballot box, and to decrease ballot counting. They closed polling places in minority communities and limited early voting. They purged voters from registration and invented restrictive voter ID requirements. It was again John Lewis who shepherded reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, a bill that finally passed the House of Representatives in December 2019. But that bill still sleeps today on the desk of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Is there anywhere in our nation a voice that calls us to restore our rights and affirm our democracy? What we do have now in the 21st century, the voice of another Black woman speaking truth to power and calling us once more to wake up, to redress the deeply eroded rights of every citizen to vote. Stacey Abrams, a Black woman, a graduate of Yale Law School, served for 7 years as minority leader of the Democratic Party in the Georgia House of Representatives. When she ran in 2018 for governor of Georgia, she won more votes than any other Democrat in the state's history. And yet she lost to her Republican rival, Brian Kemp. All the devious ways of voter suppression had given Kemp the victory. Rather than spend her energies challenging that outcome, Stacey Abrams turned instead to truth, to uncovering the story of voter suppression. It doesn't surprise me that Stacey Abrams is the daughter of ministers and she sees the right to vote as almost sacred. She writes in her new book, Our Time Is Now, she wrote, voting is an act of faith. It is profound. In a democracy, it is the ultimate power. How do states actually destroy these rights that define our democracy? Their tools are so extraordinarily effective. Let's start with voter registration. There are some states where you get your registration through the Department of Motor Vehicles, but not every citizen drives or has a driver's license. Former Confederate states, along with other states that are facing changing demographics, effectively disenfranchised new voters by demonizing and blocking community projects that aim to find and encourage qualified citizens to register. New voters' applications are intentionally delayed and often purged. Stacey Adams' study of voter registration in Georgia, for instance, showed that 40,000 registration applications had simply disappeared in 2014. Florida blunted registration by setting a 48-hour limit for turning in your registration forms. The result of that law? More than 81,000 fewer voters had registered than in the same period 4 years earlier. Georgia found another strategy to keep voters of color off the rolls. The state put in an exact match system that required perfect data entry by state employees. The risk of mismatch is highest for people of color and for women. Take a female voter with a hyphenated last name. Her application will be rejected if the hyphen isn't properly entered. Yeah, one time I was Carrie Knowles Hance, and sometimes I wrote Knowles Hance as two words, and sometimes I'd put a hyphen between them. If that doesn't match what's in the state's data file, your registration is gone. Some states purge registered voters. Between 2014 and 2016, states took about 16 million voters off the rolls. Most of these voters were neither dead nor gone. They just hadn't voted in recent elections. The excuse for purging? Use it or lose it. No other right in our Constitution permits the loss of that right because you don't use it. You won't lose your Second Amendment right to a gun if you choose not to go hunting. Well, suppose you survived suppression of voter registration, access to a ballot and vote. Many states have closed up precincts in chosen areas and reduced early voting, which now penalizes full-time workers. Voting lines for Black voters have grown significantly longer. Oh, and have you heard the claims of voter fraud? For the record, out of 1 billion votes cast between the year 2000 and 2014, only 31 cases of voter impersonation occurred. I'm going to read that again. Out of 1 billion votes between 2000 and 2014, 31 cases of voter impersonation occurred. Yet some states have removed many once permissible forms of identification and now require a driver's license or certain government IDs or a special card. Student IDs issued by state colleges and universities were no longer allowed. And what's the next hurdle? Getting inside the voting booth. Georgia, for instance, closed up 8% of their polling places and relocated 40% of the rest ever since the Supreme Court ended the Voting Rights Act. In the US, 3,000 polling places have been closed. If your new polling place is now many miles from where you live and you have no car, will this make a difference in whether you vote? And finally, there's the story of voting by mail. Little did I guess when I planned to talk about the 19th Amendment that opposing mail-in voting would become central to our president's campaign in this time of pandemic. With just 72 days from now until Election Day, standing in line for hours at polling places will create an unacceptably high risk for the coronavirus infection. 34 of our 50 states authorize ballots by mail. 16 states allow mailing, but require excuses for requesting a mail-in ballot. Once again, voter fraud is vaunted as a danger in voting by mail. The president met early this month with his postmaster general. After their meeting, the Postal Service ended overtime for postal workers, removed more than 700 high-speed letter sorters from commission, and took off the streets an unknown number of our big blue mailboxes. And the post office has issued a stark warning to election officials that mail-in ballots will no longer automatically be moved as priority mail. Our democracy is fragile. Is it sacred to us as Unitarian Universalists? I believe that it is sacred. We believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We believe in the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. This is our faith. The power of change to restore the rights of all Americans now must begin at the federal level. Congress has the duty to preserve our democracy rather than leaving voter access to the states. Reenacting that Voting Rights Act is a first step. Federal laws can end every act that promotes suppression of the voters. Reaching that place of equality and justice will take all of our strength, our hope, and our faith. Jesus had some words to say about the power of faith. He said, "Truly I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you." May it be so. Namaste.